Hey, everybody. Welcome to Therapy Rocks, a personal growth podcast. I'm your host, Signe Darpinian, co-author of No Way, a teen's guide to positive body image, food, and emotional wisdom. My guest today, Dr. Meeta Singh, is the medical director at the Henry Ford Sleep Center in Michigan and did her training in psychiatry at the Mayo Clinic. She's going to talk to us today about changes in sleep across our lifespan, sleep and its effects on food and mood, the benefits of sleep and sport performance, and a whole lot more. Dr. Singh is also a psychiatrist and sleep medicine specialist who has been setting bedtimes and consulting for multiple NFL, NLB, NHL, and NBA teams. Owner of the World Series ring from the Washington Nationals, she was their sleep coach when they won in 2019. Dr. Singh has worked with college sports teams, large organizations, CEOs, and other C-suite executives who are aiming for success in the global world. Dr. Singh, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Sleep is often neglected in the contemporary health conversations of today. So I was thinking maybe we would start with the basics of sleep. What is this behavior that we engage in for one third of our day, but don't talk so much about?
Okay, well, so you named a few key things right in your question, right? So it is a normal physiological behavior. And the way it's characterized is there is disengagement from the environment, and there's unresponsiveness to the environment. So it forces us to rest. It occurs periodically every 24 hours. It's reversible, and that is how we differentiate it from coma. And although, you know, you and I and most people look like they're very rested, very still, very quiet, in fact, in your brain, it's a very active process in the sense that your brain waves are quite active. There are different chemicals in the brain being secreted at different times, and as a result of which you have, you know, different sleep stages. So depending on what your brain waves look like, there are really two main stages of sleep. It's dream sleep or rapid eye movement sleep and non-dream sleep or non-REM sleep.
Okay.
And each phase is equally important. There are different processes and it's responsible for different functions. And all through the night, we cycle through different stages of sleep. What happens is that at night, when we typically fall asleep, we fall into sleep through light sleep, which is, you know, it's called N1 and N2. Then we have some amount of deep sleep, also called delta sleep. And then we have dream sleep or REM sleep. And then we wake up. And this is a typical sleep cycle. And it's approximately 90 minutes long.
Okay.
So there are a couple of things that I want to point out. So first of all, dream sleep or rapid eye movement sleep is about 20 to 25% of your total sleep time, while non-dream sleep is about the 75 to 85%. And the lighter stages of sleep is when you can easily be woken up. Stage two is the stage in which your body is preparing itself to enter the deeper stages of sleep. And so your heart rate, your blood pressure, your breathing, your body temperature, they all start to reduce. Now, deep sleep or delta sleep is where you spend about 20% of your sleep time. And it's the most restorative part of your sleep. It's when your heart rate, your breathing, they're at its lowest. Your muscles have relaxed. Growth hormone is being secreted. And of course, the other thing is the timing. So deep sleep occurs early, while dream sleep happens in the second half of the night. So the other thing is that, you know, people often ask me what stage of sleep is more important than the other. And in fact, you know, every stage of sleep is important because that's the reason why we still have it, right? Through evolution, we've maintained these different stages of sleep. They all have a certain function. And, you know, if you want to get more deep sleep, just make sure you get enough sleep, because deep sleep is a percentage of your total sleep time. And if you get enough sleep, you're likely to get enough deep sleep.
What about the changes in sleep across the lifespan?
Starting from the time when you're born, you know, babies, for example, because their brains are growing, they need a lot of, like, newborns need about 16 to 20 hours of sleep, right? Then between the ages of 1 and 4, you need about 10 to 12. If you're preteen, which is 6 to 12, that's about 9 to 10 hours. And teenagers, Signe, you'd be surprised. They need on an average about 9 hours of sleep every 24-hour period. And it's, you know, parents often underestimate the amount of sleep a teenager actually needs, but that's what the science says. Now, young adults need more sleep, but on an average, we say adults, we need about 7 to 9 hours of sleep to feel healthy.
Okay.
And if you're getting less than 6 hours of sleep, all the deficits that you may feel in your performance or your health are likely to happen. The other thing is that sleep also changes across the lifespan. So there's a delay in sleep timing and a reduction in slow wave sleep. So adolescents, teenagers become night owls, and then the amount of deep sleep starts reducing. And then slowly as you get older, there's a gradual drift and you become, with healthy aging, you start going to bed earlier. So you become more of a morning person. That's typically how the timing of your sleep will change over a lifetime.
I see. And with older adults, I hear some things out there and I don't know if they're true or not, but sometimes you'll hear like, oh, I just don't need as much sleep now that I'm older. Is that true or is that a myth?
Older adults oftentimes may sleep a little less at night because their sleep is lighter.
Okay.
And so their sleep can be easily disturbed because they often have very less or minimal deep sleep. The second thing that happens is that oftentimes if they're retired, they may take a nap, or sometimes a couple of naps during the day, and that itself will take away from their nighttime sleep.
Mm.
And so they may be sleeping a little less during the night. But when we say 7 to 9 hours, remember there is human variability. So there are some people who might be requiring less sleep. But when most people say they can get by with, 4 or 5 hours of sleep, it's probably not true.
It's not true. Okay.
Yeah.
And if someone is, let's say an older adult is getting lighter sleep at night, uh-huh, and maybe a little bit of less sleep because they're taking a nap during the day, is it all right for it to be fragmented like that? I mean, is it okay to take a nap during the day and not have the sleep happen all at one time?
What needs to happen is that there needs to be a change in their expectation about sleep. So as long as they understand that if they take a nap during the day, that their sleep requirement that night is 7 to 8, 9 hours minus the amount they've already taken.
I see.
And so that they're not spending that much time in bed and getting frustrated that they're not sleeping very well. So, as long as they understand that, it's perfectly fine. And if possible, I mean, there are siesta cultures, in the world. And when we talk about circadian rhythms, it'll become clear because there is typically during the day, Signa, there is a dip in our alertness post-lunch.
Okay.
And that's a time when taking a nap sort of is a natural thing. In siesta cultures where it's pretty hot outside and people don't want to be outside working, people may take a 90-minute nap. But then at night, they go to bed really late. And then, wake up on time. So they're in total, they may be getting the same amount of sleep, but they're not getting their sleep in one block at night.
Okay. And speaking of circadian rhythms, why do some people love the mornings and other people thrive more at night?
Well, so to answer that question, we should discuss circadian rhythms in a little bit more detail for your audience.
Okay.
So for anybody in your audience, if you've ever felt energized or drowsy at the same time every day, that's because you have your circadian rhythms to thank for. So circadian rhythms are these intrinsic timekeeping clocks that we have within us. It's approximately 24 hours. And for human beings, so for you and I and human beings, basically, the master circadian clock, it's located in our brain. It's right above the roof of your mouth.
Hmm.
And it keeps time in a 24-hour period. But on a daily basis, it gets synchronized to your environment by exposure to light and dark. So you're in LA, your circadian rhythms are synchronized to LA time. I am on the East Coast and mine are synchronized to my local time zone. So in addition to that master clock that we have in our brain, we also have local clocks in almost every cell in our body. So these local clocks are under local control and the master clock functions like a master conductor. And so it's coordinating the timing and functioning of all these clocks and so therefore all the functions in our body. And one of the things that this clock in our brain decides is our chronotype, or the question you were asking about morning or eveningness. So, you know, we have this genetically predetermined predisposition that decides whether somebody prefers to be more active in the morning and therefore goes to bed early and wakes up early, or prefers to be more active in the evening and prefers to go to bed late and sleep in, and therefore is a night owl. So does that make sense?
It does. And it makes me think of another question. At least in our culture, it seems that there's a little bit of morality there where where early birds, and I have to say, it wasn't until a couple of years ago that I was at an adolescent health conference and I learned for the first time that our circadian rhythm, so whether we are an early bird, a night owl, or somewhere in between, is actually genetic, which makes a lot of sense. But why is it that in our culture, in the United States anyway, they're night owls, they sort of get a bad rap?
Right. Well, so think about it, right? The early bird gets the worm.
Oh, yeah. Early bird gets the worm. Okay.
Yeah. And I think I think it's sort of universal.
Is it? Okay.
Yes. I'm a morning person. And I have to say that we are guilty of being a little smug about the fact that we can.
I had been. I didn't want to say it today, but I was a little bit like, it sort of took the air out of me a couple years ago. I'm like, what if it's genetic? It's harder to be moralistic about it.
Yes. However, I have to tell you that I'm a morning person. My husband is a night owl. And I also envy the fact that he can, you know, stay up late and finish a movie, you know, do fun things in the night while I kind of fall asleep earlier and wake up early. You know, this brings us to this very important thing about sleep, which is the three things that we should keep in mind when it comes to describing sleep. You know, there's the quantity of sleep, there's quality of sleep, and then there is the timing of sleep.
Okay.
So we talked a little bit about the quantity of sleep, which is, you know, on an average, adults need about 7 to 9 hours of sleep. There's some variation. And that's really important. It's like, you know, if you're getting on a regular basis less than 5 or 6 hours of sleep, I don't care what the quality or the timing of your sleep is, because it's like calories, right? If you are not taking in enough calories to sustain life, I don't care what the quality of those calories are, as long as you take enough calories to at least sustain life.
Sure.
So the quantity of sleep is really, really important. And then, of course, the second is the timing of sleep, which you and I were just talking about. So some people are night owls, others are morning people. And it's very essential. It is essential to align your sleep time to your own individual circadian rhythms.
Okay.
Because your 24-hour internal clock is regulating your sleepiness, your alertness, your various bodily functions. And so there may be an optimal, you know, window of opportunity for your bedtime, and you want to be in alignment to this. And I have to tell you, that's one of the things that happened during COVID and shutdown. Because people were working from home, because schooling was happening at home, people were going to bed late.
Oh.
And so there was this latest study that just came out yesterday. It's a Fitbit study, and they collected data and they compared it to the times when, you know, prior to the shutdown, and people actually were getting more sleep and they were going to bed late and waking up later, especially teenagers, because they were sleeping in alignment to their circadian rhythms.
I noticed that, but what if they can't? I mean, most people can't, right? So a night owl, for example, they can't get to bed early, and they try to go to bed early and they can't do it.
Yeah.
Aren't they losing a couple of hours of really important sleep?
Yes, they absolutely. What you brought up is a very important topic, because our sleep is not just decided by our biology. You know, I would challenge anybody in the audience to raise their hands or to say that, you know, their sleep has not been affected by their job, their social life, you know, their family situation. Because we don't live in isolation. And so since I am a morning person, I may be busy at night and cannot get to bed on time because I have to be up with my teenagers who are doing homework. But then because I have to wake up, because I'm, you know, I automatically wake up at 5 or 6 in the morning, that means I'm going to get less sleep.
Right.
On the other hand, say my husband is the night owl and he cannot fall asleep before midnight or 1 o'clock, but then has to wake up at 5 in the morning or 6 in the morning to go to clinic, well, then he's going to get less sleep.
But why doesn't his sleep pressure build up so that he can go to bed earlier? It doesn't work that way?
To a certain extent, it will.
Okay.
However, and this is a little complicated, it's a very nuanced story. So what happens is that our alertness, so when people wake up in the morning, that circadian clock, in response to bright light, secretes an alerting signal that opposes that sleep drive that builds up, the sleep pressure that builds up.
Okay.
Now, in the mid-afternoon, there's a slight dip in the alertness, which is why, you know, and it's mid-afternoon. So mid-afternoon for me, maybe between 1 and 3 in the afternoon. For a night owl, it may be 4 and 6 in the evening, right? Because they woke up late and for them, it's delayed. But then it increases. And in fact, before your biological bedtime, it's actually pretty high. It's actually pretty difficult to fall asleep before your actual bedtime.
Okay.
Because you're fighting against this high alertness signal. So yes, if you did this on a chronic basis, if you're very, very sleepy, you'd probably fall asleep anyway. And in quiet, sedentary, boring situations would unmask that sleepiness and you'd fall asleep. But it does become difficult. So for people who are significant night owls, what they'll tell you is they'll get into bed. They're like already, they want to get into bed and they're wide awake.
Yeah.
In fact, they're not just are they wide awake, but that's the time when they can do their best work.
Amazing.
Right? And so they're like, well, if I want to write a paper or if I want to paint a painting, or if I want to do something important, that's the time I want to do this. And you're telling me that I should be wasting this time going to bed.
Yes. I've heard that some people actually think they have insomnia because they are night owls genetically, but they're not recognizing this. They try to go to bed early, can't get to sleep, and they think they've got a sleep problem when in reality, they are night owls.
Well, Signe, I can tell you've done your homework.
Oh, yeah.
Yes, you're right. That's exactly right. So I often will see people or patients or, because I work, as you know, with professional athletes who, especially sometimes in college, I see a lot of, Division I college athletes. These are top athletes and they are, if left to their own devices, they'd go to bed at 2 or 3 in the morning and they'd wake up between 11 so that they could get themselves to class at 1 o'clock in the afternoon. But if they have to be at the weight room at 7 in the morning, or if they have to be at swim practice at, 6 in the morning, well, yeah, they're not going to, they think they have insomnia because they try to go to bed at 10 when, let's talk. I want to say one more thing about it.
Okay.
Because what happens is that the clock time is not the same for everybody. So for me, who goes to bed at about between 9 and 10 and likes to wake up between, 5 and 6, midnight is the middle of the night.
Okay.
But for a night owl who goes to bed at 2 in the morning and likes to wake up at 10, midnight is not even the beginning of the night.
Oh, I see.
And so that makes a big, so those are important things. I want us to circle back before I forget, because I remember I talked about those three important things for sleep.
Yes.
So one was the quantity, one was the timing, but then the other thing, of course, is good quality sleep. So, good quality sleep basically is that you fall asleep within half an hour of getting into bed, you sleep, 85 to 90% of the time you are in bed. And there are a few things you can do to help with the quality, you could reduce the amount of light exposure, reduce the amount of caffeine late in the evening, because that'll disturb the quality of your sleep. Reduce alcohol use before bedtime. Make sure your bedroom is cold and dark and quiet and relaxing, and minimize electronic use. So, there's just some things that you've probably read about.
I have read about those things. And while we're on the turning off social media and the blue light, I don't want to assume that everybody knows why that is. I mean, I think we've heard that, good sleep hygiene, make sure that your room is really dark, turn off your electronics so that you don't have any blue light. What does the blue light do? Why is it problematic?
Okay, so now I have to tell you, there is some controversy out there.
Okay.
But I'm going to first start out with simple facts.
Okay.
So we've known that your circadian clock uses light as a signal. Bright light is an alerting signal. It's really like an alertness pill. While darkness is at the right time, is a signal to your brain that you're ready to sleep. And so in response to darkness, your brain secretes this hormone called melatonin, which is a nighttime, that helps and strengthens nighttime physiology for human beings. Now, what happens when you're on your electronic media is that the light from that might suppress melatonin. So there's been studies, and here's the thing that, you know, different people react differently. So for some, you know, there was a very elegant study done out of Australia. They were looking at the amount of light exposure that will reduce melatonin secretion by 50%.
Okay.
You know, and they found there was such a huge variation. So there were some people that something as low as, you know, 3 lux was, or maybe it was 30 lux. I'll have to check that, but very low exposure would suppress melatonin. In others, it would take a larger amount of melatonin. Now, the problem with electronic media is that these are handheld, or they're devices that are backlit and they have LED lights that are coming from them. And what they do is they actively suppress melatonin, right? But the other thing, Signa, which is even more important, is, you know, what are you doing on those computers?
Right.
Right. Are you playing video games?
Are you watching the news?
Are you watching the news? Yes. You know, are you playing video games? So when I work with athletes, you know, they're playing video games. They're playing with the other teammates. So they're even keeping them up. And those are interesting, right? I mean, you know, social media or any of these social media and electronic, these devices, they have ways to keep you going when you're on the media, right?
I see.
It sucks time. You know, you go in and you think, well, okay, I have had a very busy day. I'm going to relax by spending half an hour on Instagram. And you look up and it's, you know, 45 minutes later.
Right.
Or it's an hour later. You don't know where the time went. So that's the other thing. So it's also, you know, I would say that they, sometimes when I'm working with the young athletes, I tell them, you know, read a book, because it'll unmask sleepiness. It's not going to be as interactive. Like you were saying, are you watching the news? Well, are you getting aggravated by the news? Are you getting anxious by the news? That's going to prevent you from falling asleep.
Sure.
So that's the reason why we tell people, you know, you can't be working or you can't be on social media and then suddenly turn around and command yourself to fall asleep. That's not how sleep happens.
Okay, so the blue light suppresses the melatonin, but then the other factor is that the engagement with the social media that you're on, whether it's a game or the news or you're scrolling Instagram. And I like how you said that doing something like reading a book will help you unmask your sleepiness. That's a really cool phrase.
Right. Well, so sleepiness has this very unique characteristic to it, which is that if you're sleepy, but if you're under bright light, if you're walking around, if you're motivated, if you're interacting, you're not going to feel sleepy, right?
Right.
I mean, you know, you can mask that sleepiness, but quiet, boring, dull, sedentary situations will unmask sleepiness. So if you can be interactive and working with somebody, but you get in the car, you start driving home. Well, driving is a quiet, boring, dull, sedentary situation. And you're like, well, I can't believe how sleepy I am suddenly.
Right.
I'm sitting in traffic and I'm falling asleep. And that's the unmasking. And that's why, you know, driving is dangerous, because you may not realize how sleepy you were until you actually got in the car.
Oh, I see. What a great point. You know, Dr. Singh, while we're on melatonin, I'm going to ask you, I don't really even know what terminology to use for talking about sleep aids, sleep medication, or sleep supplements such as melatonin. What do you have to say about how to categorize these?
I will say that the problem is that, as you know, Shikha, that, I mean, there are a lot of people have a lot of sleep issues and often reach for sleep aids.
Yes.
For example, there's magnesium, there's starched cherry juice. Then there's, of course, there are plenty of over-the-counter sleep aids that contain diphenhydramine or doxylamine or and I would say, again, let me count the ways, because this is going to make me unpopular, but really these products are really indicated only for very occasional difficulty with sleep. They're not meant for chronic use.
Right.
Right. So, and in general, the evidence to support their use is lacking. Mm-hmm. And there may be questions about their safety, especially if they're used chronically. And I would always say that if you, on a chronic basis, you're taking something to help you fall asleep, well, talk to your primary care doctor.
Yes.
Or talk to, because that needs further evaluation.
I'm assuming that it might help you fall to sleep more quickly, but it impairs the quality of your sleep.
Well, yes. And whatever you're taking may prevent you from staying asleep or getting into deeper stages of sleep. Again, you know, unknown, because sometimes the things that people are taking have not been studied. I can tell you the most, one of the things that people use a lot to help them sleep is alcohol.
Oh, alcohol. Yes.
Yeah. And the way alcohol works is that, in fact, when you're about to fall asleep, alcohol will actually help you fall asleep faster. But however, as it gets metabolized through the night, it fractures your sleep. So it will lighten the stages of your sleep, and it'll fracture REM sleep. And so it will definitely impair the quality of your sleep. The other thing is that you're going to develop tolerance to this effect of alcohol. And so today you may need, one glass of wine to help you fall asleep. In about 3 or 4 weeks, you may need 2 glasses of wine for the same effect. And so that's a slippery slope right there. The other thing I have to tell you is that people don't realize how much caffeine they might be taking.
Mm-hmm.
And, so drinking a double espresso after dinner is a bad idea for your sleep. So let's
right.
just say that.
Well, and what about, the piece about alcohol? I definitely have been doing my homework and reading up, and it is a bit of buzzkill. I think it's going to be for people listening, but it's true. I hear you in that it helps you get to sleep, maybe fall asleep, but not, it fractures your sleep, so you don't get the same quality.
Yes.
What about melatonin as a supplement? Would melatonin be called a supplement?
Well, so remember, what the background was. So melatonin is a hormone that your brain naturally produces.
Right.
In response to darkness.
But when you're taking it, is it a supplement?
It is. It can be taken as a supplement. It's synthetically available. You have to be careful about a couple of things. Number one is, so first of all, the American Academy of Sleep Medicine does not recommend melatonin for insomnia. So which is, problems initiating or maintaining sleep or falling, staying asleep or non-refresh. So according to the practice guidelines, there is not enough strong evidence on the effectiveness of melatonin supplementation for chronic insomnia at all. Number one.
Why do so many people take it? Is that, this has got to drive you crazy. Is that part of the disinformation?
Well, it is disinformation. It's readily available.
Oh.
In parts of Europe, you can't get melatonin without a prescription, so it's not taken as much. So, right. And then the third thing I have to tell you is that it's because it's not closely regulated by the FDA, because it's considered a supplement. There was a study, it's been a few years when it came out, and they looked at the amount of melatonin in different formulations, and they found that it ranged from, there was like, in some did not have any, and in others there was 800 times the amount of melatonin or 400 times the amount of melatonin, which is, it's a terrible thing, because you don't want to be taking these huge amounts of melatonin. Plus it was mixed with other things, so that, people put other things in it to help you fall asleep. So again, I would tell people that, okay, now having said that, occasionally using melatonin, especially for jet lag or for when you're trying to get a night out to fall asleep earlier, is perfectly fine as long as it's done under the supervision of somebody who knows what they're doing.
It sounds like that's not often the case, but I hear you. So Dr. Singh, I'm going to switch gears and ask you, how does undersleep affect the way we eat?
Oh, yes, absolutely. So, one way to think about this is that sleep plays a key role in every health-related issue, right? And poor sleep can cause insulin resistance, and which is, again, it's a precursor to type 2 diabetes. And insulin is that hormone that moves that sugar from your bloodstream into your body's cells to be used as energy. And when your cells become insulin resistant, there's more sugar that remains in the bloodstream. And as a result, you know, the body starts producing more insulin to compensate. So there is both a reduction in the ability of insulin to clear glucose,
okay,
and glucose metabolism is impaired. So the take-home point for your audience would be that if you get less sleep, what that does is that makes you hungrier and you crave fatty, carbohydrate-rich food. And this is a very interesting finding because this has been this is done on experiments. So what happens is that your brain secretes a chemical that's called leptin, and it's a satiety hormone, and it regulates your appetite, and it tells your brain that you're full. And so when you're sleeping at night, it helps you tolerate that 8 hours of fasting that you do. And if you're sleep deprived, leptin is reduced, and as a result, you're going to constantly feel hungry, and it's going to slow down your metabolism. The other hormone that we talk about is ghrelin, which does the exact opposite of leptin. So it tells your brain when you need to eat. And if you are asleep, levels of ghrelin will decrease. And if you don't sleep, it increases. And so you become hungrier. And so if you're not sleeping, you're likely to be hungrier. And it's probably evolution's way of protecting our hunter-gatherers, right? If you weren't sleeping at night, you'd be in danger. So you obviously would have to consume more calories to store to use later at night, right?
That's amazing. So that's food. What about mood?
I have to tell you, Signa, that mood, mental health, and sleep are intricately, attached to each other. It's a bi-directional relationship in which, one is going to make the other worse, or one is going to improve the other. Studies have shown that even partially getting less sleep has a significant effect on mood. So, if you don't get enough sleep, you're more likely to feel stressed, you're angry, sad, you're mentally exhausted. And of course, think of sleep as being a nightly reset button. So every night, it sort of equips you to cope with the stresses of the next day. And if you get less sleep, you're less likely to cope. As a result, you're more likely to be anxious. And if you are anxious, you're less likely to sleep at night. And that it's like a vicious cycle, right? So definitely it affects mood and anxiety. But there are some unique things. So number one is that depression and insomnia or poor sleep are, again, related to each other. And in fact, they can worsen each other. Mm-hmm. So, if you're depressed, poor sleep can worsen depression. If you're depressed, that makes you sleep poorly. And treating one doesn't automatically treat the other. In fact, if you don't treat the poor sleep, which is associated with depression, depression is going to last longer.
Yeah.
And did you know that actually poor sleep is a stronger risk factor for suicidal ideation than even depression?
I can imagine.
Yeah. So even the act of staying awake itself is a risk factor for suicidal ideation. And it could be because, you're up at night, your loved ones are awake, are asleep. So they're not around there to protect you. They're, or to talk you out or to help you cope with whatever's happening. And, if you're up at night, even small things seem pretty bad.
Right.
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 Your perspective on things sort of changes. So that's another thing to be mindful of. To me, of course, like I say, I tell people, sleep touches everything, Signa. It touches everything. But the effect on mental health is really profound. And you really can't talk about mental health without giving sleep health a seat at that table.
Dr. Singh, why, kind of back to my introduction, why is it left out? It's like it doesn't, I've even left it. I'm a therapist and I've even left it out myself. I started studying it a couple years ago, but I've been a therapist for 20 years. Why is it left out of the health conversation, do you think?
Well, so I have to say that, and I think things are changing rapidly.
Yeah,
but
true.
Sleep is sort of a new field. When I did my residency, 20 plus years ago, I remember. So for example, when I went to medical school 1,000 years ago, I don't remember learning about sleep at all. I was introduced to sleep only in my second or third year of my residency. In my final year of residency, I did a rotation in sleep medicine and I absolutely fell in love because it's so unique. And so, sleep medicine as a science has really been around for about 35 to maybe 40 years now.
Okay.
And so it is sort of new. For some reason, you know, I was reading that, you know, many, many years ago, they were talking about how, you know, smoke, the things that they wanted to get rid of was smoking and too much sugar intake, and sleep deserves to be right up there.
I mean, sleep is so foundational. I'm just surprised that it's taken so long for it to be acknowledged.
Right. But I think things are really, really changing. I think people are.
I think they are too. I mean, the fact that it was the hot topic at the adolescent medicine conference that I was telling you about is a great sign. You know, it's a great sign.
Right. And I mean, you know, adolescence is, that's such a unique time in your life, right? So think about this, right? You're so much pressure. What you're going to do in life all depends on how well you do. And adolescents are biologically wired to be night owls. Mm-hmm. They really should be going to bed later, and we should allow them to sleep in. And yet, mm-hmm. you know, we're waking them early to go to school at an ungodly hour, right?
Right.
So for school start times of 8 a.m. Again, remember the clock on the number on the clock. For me, 8 a.m. is, you know, 3 hours after I wake up.
Right.
For a teenager, 8 a.m. maybe, you know, 2 hours before they would naturally wake up at 10 in the morning.
Which are critical hours,
yes.
Right, of their deep sleep.
Yes, and dream sleep. And dream sleep adds emotional context to your memories and is important for so many things. And, you know, drowsy teens is like number one killer.
I saw that.
As is mental health. And, you know, we just talked about it.
Right.
Right. And as is, you know, they drowsy teenagers are likely to be more distracted while they're driving. They're more likely to be on their phone,
right,
etc. And, you know, there's been, I think it was University of Minnesota, where they delayed their school start times and found that these teenagers were happier.
Oh, sure.
You know, they got better grades. They were less grumpy. There were less accidents. I mean, there's no reason to continue doing what we're doing, really.
Yeah, I mean, it's really very risky. It's like trying to build a house without the foundation.
Yes. I mean, they are the foundation of our society.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
Okay, so we talked about undersleep. What about oversleeping? I have permission to share this today, but I have a client, more than one client, but one of my clients sleeps sometimes 12 to 15 hours a day.
Okay. Well, this is important. Let's address.
Okay.
You know, let's address what oversleeping actually means, right? So we talked about how the gold standard of normal has long been considered, you know, 7 to 8 hours, right?
Right.
It's a median benchmark. That's what the National Sleep Foundation, that's what all the verified sources say. So the right amount of sleep that you need is really individual. So some people will feel great at 7 hours. Others will need a little longer. But for most studies, and in fact, all the experts agree that over 9 hours of sleep is excessive. So if you're sleeping a little longer on the weekend, it's likely no big deal. But
right.
If you're regularly sleeping more than 9 hours every night and you're still not feeling well rested, then it's definitely worth taking a closer look.
Yes.
And, you know, you have to evaluate the quality of their sleep, right? So is it that they may have a sleep disorder? Yeah, you know,
right.
For example, if you have sleep apnea, you may think you're getting 9 or 10 hours of sleep, but if you're waking up once every minute or so, you may not be getting that amount of sleep. And then, you know, sometimes it's medications. Right.
Okay. I mean,
you and I know there are certain medications that will, or comorbid conditions like depression, chronic pain, or, you know, sleep apnea, narcolepsy, bruxism. There's so many potential contributing factors. I think that Signa, that your client should speak to a sleep specialist, and it's very easy to get one.
Is
because,
it? Okay.
Yes. Well. So go to the American Academy of Sleep Medicine website, and they typically have a list of accredited sleep centers and physicians associated with it.
Okay.
And the best place to start maybe would be a primary care physician who would refer them. But what your client needs is a general overview of their sleep habits. You know, their sleep environments, a good thorough sleep-wake history, a medical history to see what is actually contributing to this excessive sleepiness.
Okay. Interesting. But that's really good information. Dr. Singh, what I've heard you say in the media is that what an athlete does on the field or on the court is a result of everything they've done before they get on the field or the court.
For most people, when they see the athlete, they see them, you know, when they're on the NBA court for that 90 minute when they're playing, or when they're, you know, on, you know, playing tennis or whatever sport they're playing, right? Mm-hmm. However, that athlete has used the last 20 hours to prepare for those 2 to 3 hours that you're going to be seeing them. And sleep is a very, very, it's a big chunk of change there, right? Yeah. If athletes need about 9 to 10 hours of sleep for optimal health, well, you know, optimizing that and will make a big difference. Now, sleep is, you know, think about sleep for at least for athletes as a single switch circuit board, because it affects every aspect of athletic performance. So, you know, let's count the ways where it affects their reaction time. It makes athletes slower, less accurate. It affects their decision-making capabilities. It contributes to errors. It reduces the amount of growth hormone that's secreted. And actually, for like male athletes, it reduces the amount of testosterone that's secreted. Mm. And it impairs the way that our bodies or our muscles metabolize glucose, which is, you know, an essential fuel for an athlete. It increases their chances of developing injuries. And once they're injured, it takes them longer to get recover if they don't get enough sleep. You know, it increases their perceived effort. They feel kind of crappy. They're more fatigued. They may have mood disturbances. Again, they may have difficulty coping. There's multiple reasons why athletes can be stressed. And it's the stress that not just they have, it's the stress that their coaches, the expectations of their coaches and fans might put on them. Signa, you know, for most people, when we look at, especially professional athletes, we think of them as being having these very glamorous lifestyles. But to be successful, they really have to have these disciplined lifestyles and sleep and, you know, taking care of their nutrition and training and, you know, preparing for their sports. It's a major chunk of the time that when they're preparing so that they can be on television for you guys.
Right. I see. And is sleep getting a lot more attention in the world of athletics?
Oh, it definitely is. It's, you know, a few years ago, sleep was getting, it was like Gatorade. When Gatorade first came about, people were like, why do athletes need to be hydrated? Well, nobody questions that now. And we're almost at that stage where people say, well, you know, of course, the sleep is something that is every athlete needs because it is what recovery is.
How long has it been getting more recognition for athletes?
Well, that's a good question. And I always tell people that it's been getting more reaction in the last few years, I would say 10 years or so, especially since, you know, there's more drug testing.
Right.
So a long time ago, you could, you know, athletes were drinking, like especially in MLB, for example, they'd be taking amphetamines and could get away with, you know, taking steroids, etc., which would mask the effects of sleep deprivation. And now they're now they're being tested. So it's time to do the right thing.
Would you describe what a wind down routine is to our listeners?
Okay. So mental overactivity is a big problem, right? It's for many people, and there's some helpful things you can use to help quieten things down for night. So first of all, it's very important to give yourself some mental and physical winding down time, because we're so busy that there's just not enough time during the day to get everything done. And as a result, many people are working, right? They're doing either like things at home or work or managing stuff up till bedtime. Mm-hmm. But then sleep is not just like an on-off switch, right? We can't like get into bed and say, well, now I have to sleep. You need to wind down and sort of dim our mind so that you can set the stage for sleep to happen. And I would say a good winding down timing would be between 30 to 45 minutes. It really depends on how stressed you've been. You know, for many athletes or for many people, when they're very stressed out, well, then you're going to need longer time to de-stress and, you know, prepare for your bedtime. But it's like creating a closure for the day.
Oh, that's nice.
Right, right. So I would tell people, set an alarm. So if you want to go to bed at about, say, 11:30, then you might want to set an alarm 45 minutes earlier that reminds you, you know, you have to dim your lights, avoid using a screen you know, avoid being on electronics, maybe reading, light stretching, journaling, meditation is good. You know, if you have a faith-based practice, that's a good time to do it.
Okay.
And also, yeah, I should talk about this. So, you know, don't worry in bed. So sometimes what happens is people are so busy that the first time they get into bed is the first time they allow themselves to think. And so their overactive mind now is, you know, it starts reviewing the day, it starts thinking about the day the next day. And you can prepare by that by keeping a worry journal. So sometimes early in the evening, sit down with, you know, electronic or a piece of paper and write down all your thoughts or make a schedule so that you can now tell yourself you've already done that worrying earlier.
I heard this phrase of, you know, nighttime or bedtime is a time of reception, not reflection.
Yes. Very. I love that.
Yeah.
I love that. Yes.
It's so nice.
Right, right. And, you know, that's why I, you know, if you have a practice of meditation or mindfulness during the day, that's a useful skill to use when you're up, if you have problems with sleeping at night, because all that, you know, instead of getting mad at yourself, if you were non-judgmental and accepting of the fact that you're not sleeping, that might actually help you sleep, fall asleep, rather than really getting mad at yourself and commanding yourself to fall asleep, because that's one way to drive sleep far away.
Right, exactly. Well, Dr. Singh, thank you so much for the work you do and cutting through all the hype and disinformation that we talked about with sleep and providing evidence-based information on getting your sleep right.
Thank you so much, Signa, for having me on, and thanks for giving me a platform.
What's the best way for our listeners to find your work?
Well, I do have a website. It's meetasinghmd.com.
Well, it's been great to have you on. I find sleep to be such a fascinating topic. Thank you for joining us today for another episode of Therapy Rocks. And a reminder that you can rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. And feel free to contact me at www.signadarpinian.com. We'll see you next month.